Thank you. Thank you for the introduction and the kind invite, and particularly to Atif for inviting me to be in conversation with him today. Atif and I have a long history together, haven't we? It goes back to when I was writing What It Means to Be Palestinian. He introduced me through his knowledge of the Arabic language and translating into English. He introduced me to, you know, kind of thinking about the aesthetics of language and the ways that we can think about it in different ways. And I think he approaches that very eloquently in this book. I just wanted to make this like a conversation so that we can provide you with a snapshot or perhaps a simple introduction to what this book is about. And I wanted to to ask Atif a general question, which is, why poetry, why politics, why the Arab world, and then kind of challenge him further in his choice of the connection, you know, sort of in a sense, it's making a statement as in terms of the title. And the book does make a very coherent statement, but maybe Atif, can you talk to us about it a bit more?
Well, thank you very much all for coming first, and it's very nice to see many familiar and unfamiliar faces, all nice here. But I would like to really thank Dina very much as well for the kind introduction. We have been working together for a long time, and it's always nice when I get opportunity to thank her for all the good things we have done together and for her warmth and support throughout the years. Now, regarding the book, there is a very strong language, a very strong connection between Arabic poetry and between politics. So the relationship exists. It's the nature of the relationship that one can discuss in detail. But as for the rationale of the book, it came from the idea that if you look at all Arab poets from even old times to the present time, in one form or another, they're all engaged with political events and with political thought in general. And that could even be sometimes philosophical. But the idea of politics and the idea of power and the idea of how to organize a human society, how to organize a human community, has always been an indispensable theme in the history of sort of Arabic culture in general, in the Arab world. And that connection somehow, it exists in various forms, in various ways, sometimes directly and sometimes indirectly. And so some poets are sometimes thinking of language in terms, poetic language in particular, in ways that are free of the immediate effect and immediate sort of role of politics on poetry, and some poets think of poetry as something that has to be really free, a free form of expression that is not tied to political events, that has no relationship to politics in general. So now coming to that has always been sort of the oscillation between how much poetry is related to politics or how much politics is related to poetry in a way. Now the modern period in particular is very interesting because from the 19th century, as a lot of you would know, there have been a lot of major political transitions that are of kind of momentous nature, whether a transition from the Ottoman Empire to the nation-state system in the Arab world. And also it's a period we start from the 19th century is known as a period of awakening, or Nahda, the word, the Renaissance or awakening in the history of the Arab world. So, and this awakening is also linguistic awakening. It is somehow sharpening the consciousness of regarding Arab nationalism, regarding the Arab world, its culture, the shifting of political consciousness from one that is tied to the Ottoman Empire and the interaction of the Arab world with it to something that is more nation-state specific or pan-Arab in general. And that's how where we have the beginning of the story of modern Arabic poetry, with a period of Renaissance and reflection on how the modern Arabic language can sort of reflect and adapt to this modern period where you have very big political changes happening, and where poetry came to speak to these political changes. But later on, there have been more nuances were added to what poetry is in relation to politics. At the beginning, the poetry, insofar as its relation to politics and its relation to Renaissance as a movement in general, is quite immediate in the way it informs. It talks about political stirrings, it talks about political changes, it talks about Arab nationalism. So the form in which poetry is conveyed is rather... it's not obscure, it's more immediate. But of course, because of the very nature of the medium of expression, which is poetry, you get sometimes existential insights into the time in a way that you might not get from other forms of expression and reflection. So that's where the relationship starts. But obviously, one can go back to the history of the Arab world and how poetry was the primary form of expression. And in the modern period, it also continued to be, perhaps until the 50s, 60s, when Najib Mahfouz comes to the scene, and then the novel also takes a sort of a center stage, becomes very, very important, and increasingly so. But poetry, but also another thing about the 20th century that is fascinating, we could open up another discussion about it, but another thing is that it's really sort of poetry has been in the history of the Arab world for about 15th century. That's a very long time, which is quite remarkable if you think of other poetic traditions. So in terms of the length of Arabic poetry and its maturity and depth as a form and as content, it has been remarkable since the 5th century to the 20th century and onwards. So in the 20th century, you have a sort of rejuvenation of the linguistic form. Poetry written in freestyle, the entry of a freestyle into the Arabic kind of consciousness and Arab culture, that is a new thing. Mm-hmm. And that is a breakaway from the old forms in which poetry was written. And also you have the emergence of great poets with great gifts, such as Adonis, Mahmoud Darwish, and before that, Jubran Khalil Jubran and Badr al-Shaki Sayyab and others. So you have a lot of things that made poetry sort of suited to express the ideals and problems of the age. And also it is in terms of the connection of the current modern Arabic poetry with the Arabic tradition itself. It was a linguistic question, but also a cultural and political question that was responded to either directly or indirectly in the poetry that emerged in the 20th century. And this, I hope I have shed some light on the kind of relationships that which I could be specific about as we move on talking about this.
Thank you. I wanted to press you a little bit further on, you know, the idea of poetry and the Arab world and the relationship to politics. So in a sense, I would like to ask you to, you know, in a way, we have this whole debate that we kind of speak about all the time, which is exceptionalizing the Arab world, in a sense. What is different about poetry in the Arab world? Is it a difference that is related to the language? Is it related to context? Is it related to what you mentioned here is existential issues, in a sense? So how do you respond to that? You know, sort of, do you kind of locate it as something... or a genre of itself that is different from other genres of poetry that have evolved in other contexts, like, let's say, Africa. So if you could respond to that, is there...
Yeah, no, I think that's a very compelling question. Because I think there is something to... It's not about exceptionalism in sort of a historical way. If there is exceptionalism to Arabic poetry, it is very much to do with the historicity of the Arab world, which is the historicity of the Arabic language, the continuity, the access that Arab poets in the modern period that they have to the 5th century, to to the 7th century, which is a major sort of breakpoint, change, transition in Islam, and then the tradition, the Arabic tradition from the 7th century to about 13th, 14th century. I normally mention sort of the end would be Ibn Khaldun, 14, 15, so that's the time. So during this time, you have a very incredible kind of movements of poetry, thinkers, and poetry was very indispensable to that tradition. And then you have interruption, sort of, which is the Ottoman Empire, in terms of the linguistic access to that poetry. So I think if you think of other traditions, I'm aware of the English tradition, for example, you have a sort of continuity of some sort that is, of course, much later than Arabic. You start, one doesn't really know English poetry, you don't go to Beowulf, it starts with the Chaucer, that sort of 12, then onwards, the poetic traditions that, and then one handing into another. And then in terms of the poetic influences, and the language reaches its peak with Shakespeare, and then continuity from there with the kind of rationalist movement and the romantic movements that emerged in the 19th century and so on. With Arabic, you do have interruption, which is quite striking in terms of as poetic schools go. And then you have the 20th century, this eruption of Renaissance, which language was indispensable to. So in a way, politics have interrupted Arabic poetry in a way that is... In a major way, which is through the Ottoman Empire, where there was not really much poetry. It was not a very... there is, but not very interesting. It's to do with weddings and celebrations. It's not very profound reflection on human conditions or any of this sort. So that, in a way, poetry was reclaimed as a sort of a torchbearer of Arab consciousness, particularly in the 19th century. Arab consciousness and Arab bride in the past, and return to that past and bringing continuity from there in a way that is really hard, and also that is hard to see in other traditions in the same way, this kind of interruption and this kind of link with politics and with political consciousness. And also the fact that the Arabic language itself, you have a form of accessibility to it to the 5th century, which is the poetic tradition before in Arabia, and then to the pre-Islamic poetry, I mean, and then poetry during Islam and then after. You have accessibility to it. So most poets who were very important poets in the 19th century, the 20th century is the beginning, had actually studied or memorized a lot of the Arabic poetry from the past, such as Mahmoud Sami al-Barudi, the new classical, and they named it the new classical school, which is kind of continuity. So to answer your question, there is a very compelling kind of strands of connection and connections between Arabic poetry and politics, and it's to do with the history of the world and the Arab world and how it went, and also to do with this accessibility to language that you don't see quite in the same way in other traditions, more or less. That is not perhaps so much of an exceptional and exotic way, but it's exceptional in the sense of it's that it's interesting, and it's also quite the Arabic poetry as a tradition. It's reached heights of maturity and depth and breadth also in terms of the phenomena that is maybe not as strong as in other traditions. But it's worth also reflecting. I mean, other people might have other thoughts on this.
Yeah. Very interesting. So, as you were speaking, I was thinking of the idea of the aesthetics, mm-hmm. and whether aesthetics as feeling or aesthetics as kind of being very involved in what the poetry means. So, in a sense, as aesthetics as does that come from the language, or does that come from the what the language says? So in a sense, this very much might relate to what you're talking about in terms of exceptionalism. So in a sense, what you're saying, if I understood correctly, that it's the context, it's the kind of evolution of poetry that, you know, because many discussions around the Arab world and around kind of the global south is around the notion of orality, oral culture. So, you know, I'm kind of interested in the way that you approached it without, you know, repeating all these notions about orality, but So orality and aesthetics, perhaps you could...
I mean, there is. I think there are two. There are a few dimensions to this question, which is the dimension that relates to the past and how Arabic poetry itself was orally transmitted, and therefore the sound, the importance of the sound, and in sort of in kind of colloquial language, the importance of embracing people through the sound has been there in Arabic poetry. But I think also the connection with aesthetics actually is very, very important, because in terms of the way the tradition develops, it develops from sort of, which is interesting, because the past here, the present mirrors the past in some ways. In the past, it develops in a way where you have poetry expressing the immediate concerns, the political concerns, the political events, the cultural events that are happening. The sort of the existence before Islam, the existence of the human conditions of the tribe, really, and the tribal system that is there. And obviously, it's a profound poetry in certain ways. Some poems are very profound as reflection on human conditions at the deepest level, in terms of and the integration of aesthetics into these conditions. But then you have Islam, which is a form of expression that is entirely new to the region, and then after that, and that is aesthetic development of a tremendous kind. And then after that, you have also the emergence of poet who think of poetry as not necessarily should or be part of expressing a political reality. It should free itself of political reality. You have Bashar ibn Bourd, you have Nafri and others who thought of poetry in terms of, it's kind of like what Adonis would later do with his poetry, which we'll come to in a minute. But it's sort of, you have an evolution of poetry where poetry moves from expressing indirect ways the political realities to something where the political realities are absorbed into the language, absorbed in the language, but not necessarily so immediate. So poetry is rather in the background. The poet is not always talking about political events and so on and so forth. And in the modern period, you have a similar development, whereby you have in the 19th century, the new classical school, it was a reflection of the political issues that were happening and the debates and thoughts and so on, in kind of indirect ways, mostly. There are some accidental points here and there that one could regard as aesthetic in themselves, as not very much expressing a psychological reality that could be, or realities that could be universal. And then poetry moves, and the discussion becomes about modernity and the relationship with European thought and relationship with the European tradition. And those European poets who influenced Arabic poetry, such as T.S. Eliot, Lorca, those become very, very important figures in the history of Arabic kind of poetry. But also the element of orality is very important, because the connection with the sound and connection with the tradition, it means the continuity of the sound as well. Mm-hmm. And therefore, the kind of the idea that when Nazik al-Malaika, the Iraqi poet and writer, she mentioned about this, when she came up, or she formalized more like it, because other people talked about it, but she formalized the notion of the free verse poetry and how it can still rely on the tradition but to free itself from the tradition. She took into consideration the sound and the orality of Arabic poetry, and she actually translated it into her poetry. And then you have the poem of Badr Shakir Sayyab, which is a kind of a major point in the history of Arabic poetry, which is the hymn of the rain, or the song of the rain, or the rain song as it's translated, in Shudat al-Matar, which is very much, it is rooted in the Arabic tradition in terms of the themes and the way it deals with nature and with political issues. And the sound is very much, is a sound from the past. And it's so in that sense, it's.
Do you remember any verses in it, or?
عيناك غابتان خيل عند الصحر أو شرفتان راح ينأى عنهما القمر. So that's what it, the poem opens with, these two lines, which is very much a hymnistic, rhymed kind of poetry that very much goes back to, that's similar. But then later on you have two major poetic, you have many, really. You have, I mean, one who's indispensable to Arabic modernity is Khalil Gibran, and he wrote about this history of the what he called the Mustaqbal al-Lugha al-Arabiyya, the future of the Arabic language, an essay that he wrote, very much predicting that poets should take the future of the Arabic language in their hands and advance that towards modernity and innovation, which is later translated in different work, in different ways in the works of particularly Mahmoud Darwish, the Palestinian poet, and Adonis, who reflect different kind of different strands of Arabic poetry, but again, strands where aesthetics become paramount, become very significant to Arabic poetry, which is, in other words, how Arabic poetry kind of free itself from the grip of politics, which is so dominant in the Arab world, and it's very integrated into mundane life in so many ways, and into the language as well. So how poetry somehow can express human ideals, how can it be a reflection of also more than just immediate political concerns and political problems.
Yeah, sensibilities I was thinking about and kind of existential issues. But my final question is your kind of the structure of the book, because I'm not sure whether some of you have read the book, but it's really very well structured. And I think you've got the history, but also case studies and... So I wanted you to reflect a bit on that and to think, you know, and your choice of the poets themselves, you know, in a way, it's always important, you know, for us when we're thinking of what we write is to reflect on why we do that. I also want to mention that Atif himself is a poet. So he doesn't like to talk about it in public, but you are. So in a way, just...
The book, regarding the history, I think it's a very important point, because actually history has been very important to the Arab world, and I mean, any other nation's history is important to them, so there's no exceptionalism there. But as I said, the point of departure to Arabic poetry in terms of the modern period is the 19th century, when we have a new movement and you have a new school of poetry called New Classical Poetry. And that continues really until the death of Ahmed Shoukat and Hafez Ibrahim in the same year, 1932. But also, as I mentioned before, there are major political events happening, and that I wanted to somehow bring that into how it how these political events and issues and debates, how they affected poetry. Mm-hmm. So I started with that sort of as a background, and in the introduction I talk about poetry in the past and its importance and so on. And in the kind of in the book, I wanted to highlight to bring this historical background, because it's actually, it is the one that foregrounds what comes later. Whatever came later, it's kind of, this was indispensable to it. The other aspect that I wanted, that I had in mind when I wrote the book, is that I wanted to reflect diversity. And in the Arab world, often one tends to generalize, or you talk about the Arabic poetry in kind of linear terms, or politics even in linear terms, or culture in homogeneous and linear terms, like the Arab world is like this, Arabic culture is like this, Arabic poetry is like this. So what I wanted to in the book to do was actually to try to reflect these very forces that are, in political terms, are contesting each other. They are forces that are sort of in conflict with each other. And that goes back, you know, in the 19th century, but with more with time, even with the nation states and the fragmentation of the Arab world, it becomes more acute. So I want to bring that a chronology in, and that was where I started with the Ottoman Empire, because it was a very important kind of period in the history of the Arab world. And then the choice of the poets was very much to do with... So as the book moves on, it moves to colonialism and then modernity in Arabic poetry in the 50s and 60s and so on, the movements that emerged, and then Islamist poetry, Hamas, Hezbollah, and then the last is a kind of summary or a reflection back on the poetry of evolution and using the poetry of the Arab uprisings in particular to highlight this. But how is that poetry rooted in Arabic poetry as well? So that's the structure of the book. But in terms of the choice of the poets, I was aware that there are too many people that I couldn't mention, and that it would be not only immodest but rather arrogant to say that everybody will, that I could cover everything and everybody with this book. So my idea was to bring the major issues and strands that have happened in the history of the Arab world in the 20th century, and see the ones that have affected the Arab world in one and different regions in one form or another, and also how they have been integral to the Arabic language in terms of its uses, in terms of the diversity of its uses as well, and to bring different examples. And that was the rationale behind the choice of the poets, but there are others that I just couldn't mention because of space, because of other reasons. And of course, one runs the risk of reductionism and the risk of not being inclusive, but I hope, and I mentioned that as sort of a disclaimer at the beginning of the book, but I hope the poets I've mentioned, another aspect is that I mentioned mostly those who have been influential. I mean, there are others who are influential, but those who have influenced political events or influenced political, not events as such, but political consciousness, cultural consciousness. So those who have sort of are known in the Arab world, and there are many others who are not well known that I also mentioned, as a sort of representing a political phenomena like political Islam, in the case of Hamas or Hezbollah. So the hope is that it's representative enough and that it does bring out the issues that I highlighted, that I wanted to highlight from the 19th century, and how they contributed and how they were part of the development of the Arab world politically, culturally, and existentially.
Thank you. And I think one thing I want to add here is that once you read the book, you see that Atif also engages with post-colonialism, with kind of globalization, with different issues, different ways of thinking about nationalism and so on. So it is not, you do engage a lot with a... It is quite an interdisciplinary book,
yes,
from that perspective.
And so, I have to say, maybe if I can add here, is actually part of my education at SOAS is also has been reflected on this book, because in a way... SOAS is such an eclectic place, and there's so many debates and so many issues. I hope it does continue. And I think it sort of reflects my education. It has been interdisciplinary. I've started with English language and literature. That was my theme. And then I carried on linguistics and literature. And these were carried with me. But also I was at SOAS taking courses in politics and attended many political events, and this is reflected, like, my interest, and the different schools that I have been exposed to also have influenced me insofar as the writing of the book is concerned.
Thank you. And you were asked to help in the media department.
Yes, absolutely. I should have mentioned that. Yes, how can I forget?
So we have
yes,
a long history.
Absolutely.
I would like to open the floor for questions. Please do ask questions. Maybe you have read the book, maybe you can think of something that you could ask in relation to our conversation. Sorry. And so do go ahead. Welcome any questions. Yes, Beth, go on.
Thank you very much for very raising really talking about a very important subject. I wanted to ask you, is it really the case that Arabic poetry was always political? I mean, the period before Islam, where we certainly have poetry from that time, very, very early centuries. Would you say that was political? And if so, in what sense do you mean it's political? That was one question. And the other thing is, perhaps you want to, can you talk a little bit about what role that the poetry itself has had on society? Has it shaped people's thinking? How has it changed it? As opposed to, obviously, poets expressing certain things. But have people, in other words, is this something very Arab, so that actually poetry itself shapes ideas and encourages or fires people and so on, unlike other cultures?
Yeah, these are actually important questions. Before Islam, certainly, have poetry always been political? And have poets... Yes and no, in the sense that if you look at the history of poetry, you can always detect... It operates at several levels and several layers. There is the layer that is, you can look at it as purely, if you look at Mu'allaqat Umar al-Qais before Islam, 6th century, one can see an existential dilemma there that he wants to, he's trying or dealing with and solving throughout his poem. But one obviously very clearly can see the political theme there is. I can go into details, but it's very clear that it's there. And most of the poets from the past were somehow reflecting on what was happening around them in their poetry. Now, it is some were not, I would say, immediately political. It's not all political. Certainly those who, like Bashar ibn Burd or others who are, as Adonis regards them, as modernists in Arabic poetry, muhdithin fi al-sha'r al-arabi, were not necessarily political, and they actually wanted to free the Arabic language of politics. That was a kind of a mission that they have taken up, as it were. And they were very much concerned with the music and sound and aesthetics and perception and imagination. But again, because as they went on writing poetry, because politics has been very immediate to them, it infiltrated. It went into the energy of their poetry. One can't find it. Like Abu al-Ala al-Ma'arri, for example, he's somebody who's, he kind of isolates him from himself or from the society. He doesn't want to write about politics. He doesn't concern him. But actually, a lot of his poetry is about how can rationalism win, as it were. And that's a political statement about the time when you have religious forces, when you have fanaticism, and a political statement that is incorporated in his poetry. If you take from the modern period, you take Adonis, somebody who claims that his poetry is not political, and he actually wants to free Arabic poetry of politics, his poetry is largely political philosophy. He is searching and talk about a human freedom. So freedom is a very important aspect to his poetry. I'm not saying all poetry is political, but I'm saying that it's an aspect that is there in the poetry, and one can find it, depending at which level one is analyzing and one is operating in terms of analysis. How it has been in terms of Arab poetry and imagination, like reflect the audience of Arabic poetry and how they have taken it, and whether it has caused serious change. I think if you go to the early period, perhaps poetry has caused the biggest changes possible, which is, I mean, part of the Islamic identity is it's poetry, the Quran, its arrangement as a text, it's the biggest effect it has, it's as a linguistic mu'jiza, and poetry is certainly related to that. How so? That's another argument, but it's in terms of the form, the convincing message, the ability, but that's a big discussion that one can go into, but certainly one can see a concrete effect and a concrete sort of epistemic shift in knowledge and in belief in all forms. In the modern period, certainly, if you look at the Palestinian identity, for example, how it was expressed in poetry through Mahmoud Darwish, I mean, people, when they think of Palestine, when they think of the culture of Palestine, it's certainly... It's poetry is one aspect that is taught of and that is people relate to. If it causes political changes, I think it can raise consciousness, it can mobilize people, which it has done in many contexts, and that's why most movements use it. Like even a movement as savage as ISIL has sort of their poetry, blurted out. And it's sort of, it's the manipulation of language. Poetry can be, as Heidegger, when he talks about Hölderlin, the German poet talks, it can be a song, it can be a gift to the people that it raises their consciousness or elevates their consciousness, and it can be dangerous, it can be a form of danger. And certainly we have these two sides in the Arab world. So how it is exactly and so on, that's a difficult question to answer. But has it been part of the Arab culture, part of the shaping of the imagination, or what you call the imagined community, as Benedict Anderson says? It certainly has been.
Any other questions? Yes, please.
I have two questions. The first one is about the use of allegory and metaphors in Arabic and Arabic poetry, and whether you would say there's more tendency to speak in allegory in Arabic poetry in comparison. Sorry, can you hear me?
Yes.
Just as a way of almost self-censorship when speaking about sensitive political or social or religious issues. And the second question was, I had something in mind. About whether you think poetry is elitist, and because you spoke about how there's accessibility in Arabic throughout all different time periods, but is it also accessible between different social classes, different socioeconomic, different socioeconomic
The first question, in terms of metaphor, I mean, metaphor is indispensable to any language. It's indispensable, even some people claim it's a universal thing, indispensable to human imagination and to language in general. So our language is primarily, mostly, is metaphorical. Now, coming to Arabic, it is very strongly so. There is the aspect of metaphor and allegory because there is... think of the past, the imagery is very important. How you make great images and how can you depict the relationship between man and nature or the tribe and its environment, all that is reflected in allegorical terms. I think the question also relates more to in the present time. In the present time you have... I think Mahmoud Darwish is very fascinating in this regard. If one studies his poetry and the symbolism he uses and the allegories he uses, it is, and I say that in comparison with Adonis, and also in comparison to the current moment that we live now, and Arabic poetry now. You have, in Darwish, just as an example, the allegory and the metaphor are connected to some sort of reality that one can relate to, whether it's a perceptual reality, it's a reality of sensibility, it's a reality of sound. It is somehow a sound that has some anchors in reality, that is anchored in some form of reality of one kind or another. In the case of Adonis, it tends to escape that immediate or not so immediate even reality. So it's poetry that tends to be transcendental. And all that is reflected through metaphors and through allegories. And they have been... And allegories also have been important because allegories for the nation, allegories for the dilemmas and tragedies of the nation, all that is incorporated into Arabic poetry, particularly as it starts to incorporate myths in its composition, like Badr Shakir's Sayyab, what do you call the Tammuz, the myths of resurrection, which is the Arab word rising, from where it was before, from what you call all kind of shackles, colonial, backward, patriarchal, all kind of these aspects. So that was a metaphor and allegory that were used very heavily and continued to be so. But it differs from one poet to another. At this current moment, poetry is excessively sometimes majazi. It's excessively metaphorical. It is sometimes one is reading a text and really hard to understand what is going on. It is not so... Because the 20th century, every poetic movement that emerged, it has a sort of philosophical background to it, which is poetic-philosophical at the same time. So there's reasoning as to why this poetry. So even Adonis, when one reads him, I mean, there's the early period of Adonis and the latter period, and they are different from each other. But even as a poet, and he justifies himself, he's a great poet at all sort of levels, whether the initial phase or the latter phase. But even though it's very hard sometimes to understand, mainly because the metaphors and the allegories he uses are not so immediate, but it's somehow, he still justifies it. There are poetic philosophical schools that justify it. the same in Darwish. Whereas now, it is not really so justified. It's sometimes sort of just an exhibitionist of some sort in terms of the use of language. The metaphors that are used are too... They're not so well put together. One doesn't see the... of course, this differs from one person to another and how you relate to poetry. So my judgment is subjective, surely. But as far as studying the phenomena itself, it's very hard to see, like, kind of well-founded schools that are backing this kind of poetry or why this poetry is like this. And of course there are very good poets and very interesting ones and voices. But I'm just giving various examples as to how metaphor and allegory can be used, and what kind of effect they might have, which is, I could talk about more, but stopping. You asked another question.
Yeah, but maybe we'll take another question and come back to that one, which is about the question of elitism.
Oh yes, yeah, elitism. Yes.
But we'll take that question and then
You mentioned T.S. Eliot, and so I wanted to ask what other Western writers or even non-Arab writers had a significant influence on Arab poetry?
Yeah. I'll answer the elitism one because I just forgot, but it's important, and then I'll come to that. Arabic poetry is elitist. It can be. I mean, it can be, but it has not. It has been. Since people have access to it through schools, through university, through daily kind of through the mundane life, people reciting poetry, it's not really been elitist in the sense that it's separate from the society, and it's been also the kind of the most people relate to some poets or others, whether those poets are avant-garde poets or local Sha'bi poets. There is a kind of a poet for everybody somehow. I mean, one could say, obviously, some poets are more dominant and more important than others, and they have sort of huge influence across the Arab world. But then, obviously, one could think of. I mean, sometimes Adonis was thought of as elitist. Some people thought Adonis and the whole school that he established is like, for example, Nizar Qabbani when he came in the 50s and 60s. He was saying, what is this talking about transcendence and escaping from politics, and when we have all this mess around us and we have so many issues to deal with? So he regarded this as elitist. But in fact, it depends which perspective and which angle you take to look at Potter. I mean, when I read Adonis and I studied him, to some extent, what he has very very valid reasons and some very very interesting perspective and very valid reasons to go on the way he did to write poetry in the way he does. His ideas are interesting. It is not necessarily elite. It's just a perspective that is interesting, that is profound, that is linked to the tradition. If other people don't have access to it because they're not able to read him well, there is what they call in the Arab word azmat qara, you know, crisis of reading. That is not necessarily elitist. So it's not the poet who's consumed most, you know, that is positive or negative. It's important to look at the diversity and what it yields. I think the one issue of concern is when poetry is bigoted poetry, when poetry is dangerous, and when it mobilizes people from a zone of ideology and of a zone of closure and complete exclusion of others. This is where poetry becomes dangerous. But elitism is quite a different, I think, category altogether. Now, T.S. Eliot is very important. Lorca has been very important. The Spanish poet has been very important. And many poets credit him in their writing. Also, Pablo Neruda has been very significant. Actually, most the modern-like kind of writers, Adonis has been influenced hugely by French poets. And it's also ironical and interesting. Sometimes he says that I've discovered modernity and even post-modernity in Arabic poetry, which is Arabic poetry of the 7th and 5th or whatever century, of the earlier centuries, through the works, through the French poets or the French writers. So that, like Rimbaud or Valéry or other poets. So it really, there are poets who were influenced by such as, so it's either the English school, it tend to be the English-speaking school, English school, or the French, some German, like Goethe. But the Arabic poetry, the modern Arabic poetry is very influenced by Western schools of thought. But also it's been a story of interaction, I think. It's not a one-way direction, kind of, with Arabic. So there are many names that one could mention, but also if you think of Lorca, for example, he was certainly influenced by the earlier Arabic tradition, which is the earlier traditions that from the classical period. So in that sense, it's an interesting relationship. It's a profound relationship that goes in various directions, and there's certainly that, which is actually goes to say that Arabic culture itself is not monolithic or pure or sort of just made by itself. It's also, like Western culture, it's made in relation to other cultures, which is natural enough. Except for Trump, maybe not, but...
You have a question? So one question here, any other questions? Okay.
Yes, I have a question. You talked about the transition from the neoclassical poets to the free verse movement, which happened, as you said, in the 40s and 50s. And I wondered whether there was a political component to that, in the sense that the neoclassicists represented a particular political vision which was then superseded by another political vision which was represented by the free verse people. And that was one question. Or whether it was completely arbitrary. My other question was, you mentioned the use of verse by recent Islamist movements, particularly Hamas and Hezbollah. And I wondered what your assessment of the aesthetic quality of that verse was, given that the general perception is that the Islamist movement has not made great contributions to artistic endeavor, generally.
Yeah, I think that's good. Very good questions. The regarding the political vision, I would say there was a political vision. The new classists were certainly tied to political visions rather than political vision, and it was because it's interesting sort of to see the backgrounds of those poets, such as Mahmoud Sami Baroudi or Ahmed Shoukry and Hafez Ibrahim. And that political vision was very much to do with an identity that was going through immediate transition and change. So I think most of their poetry was expressing, the political part of their poetry was expressing this political vision which is between the nation-state system that is coming into the Arab world and Egypt. And then the other aspect is the... I mean, that's the beginning of it. And then the other aspect is the Ottoman Empire and how important it is for the identity of the Arab world. And particularly those poets, they were partly Turkish. Their mother was Turkish. Mahmoud Sami Baroudi served in Istanbul, served in the war, was in the war against the rebellion in Greece. And Ahmed Shoukry also, his mother, and Hafez Ibrahim. So the beginning certainly is quite politically... the political moment is heavily involved in what... in how they went about poetry. But also, then colonialism comes in, and that becomes also very immediate to them. But I think they were conflicted poets, in the sense that on the one hand, they wanted to... they were very proud of the nation-state that is coming into being, and they were sort of writing poetry about their nation-states and the travails that it was suffering from. But in terms of identity at large, they will... And this is where you see difference in terms of the new classical poetry between poets from the East, Mashriq, Egypt, and in particular, And then you see difference between Assyria and Iraq, which were very near the Ottoman Empire, or Palestine for that matter, where there were persecution and oppression, like the massacre that happened in 1915, which Jamal Pasha in Beirut, and galvanized many Arab poets about it. So the political vision is very much related to Arab identity, where they basically they want to take themselves totally from the Ottoman Empire, and their poetry was... The first poem of Ibrahim al-Yazji was a very "Arise, O Arab, arise, ayyuhal Arab tanabbahu wastafiqu," which is a kind of poetry that is calling against the Ottoman Empire, but also that realized the danger of colonialism, and that is rising the Arab world against colonialism. So these are the political, the immediate political issues that were there. But in terms of how to go about it, it was between, which has been throughout the history of the Arab, between building your nation state, having independence, having a freedom from the Ottoman Empire, from colonial powers, or having a united Arab world under a different sort of with a different political center ruling over it, like some people imagine Saudi Arabia because of the two mosques, like when al-Rasafi, Ma'ruf al-Rasafi, the Iraqi poet, was right. So very much it is linked to these political issues.
And then the free verse
movement. The free verse movement is also very much, at the beginning, the free verse movement was rooted in ideals, not necessarily political visions of direct kind, and that starts mainly with Gibran Khalil Gibran, and then it carries most maturely carried on in the poetry of Abul Qasim al-Shabi in Tunisia. They are very much poets who wanted the Arab world to somehow be reformed from within, if you would like, which is through freedom and their idea of liberty and the idea of the kind of West. They were influenced, in the case of Abul Qasim al-Shabi, by French literature. And in the case of Gibran Khalil Gibran, by the case of French, and also the United States, because this is where he was. So there is that. That is these are where the influences, the political influences. But also some people later, the free verse, it came also out of the idea that the old system is no longer suited. That was really the basic idea that Nazik al-Malaika puts forth, is no longer suited to express the complexities of the modern period through just the heimstic form, the one line, and the rhyme, that language has to be free itself. And this is where the idea of syntactic grouping comes in, where you have a larger stanza, and the ability to express a larger or broader political idea, and also or ideals in general, came into being. And this is where the linguistic reforms, entered the Arabic poetry. And then later it becomes more broader picture of what a free verse could be, and that is mostly carried in the work of either Adonis or Mahmoud Darwish. And it becomes whether poetry should... It should be lyrical poetry, that how important lyricism is to poetry. And that relates to the question of the sound. And that for Darwish, lyricism was indispensable to poetry. It was very important. That's why there was a lot of resistance to prose poetry, which is also another movement that emerged in Lebanon, Uns al-Hajj in particular, within the context of the Lebanese Civil War. And there was a center of Arab culture, of Renaissance of some sort at that time. Regarding Islamist poetry, there are certainly some aesthetic merits, and there are some very moving poems sometimes, very profound, very very moving in the sense that it expresses genuine human concerns and in a way that is very aesthetic and very very free of the political moment. I mean, for example, when Abdulaziz al-Rantisi or Mahmoud al-Maqadmi, Abdulaziz al-Rantisi was a very ideologue of Hamas, largely, really, but he wrote a lot of poetry. When his wife visits him in Israeli prisons, the way he reacts to that, it's very, very moving. And it does reveal other sides to his personality and character that are very, that are thirsty for freedom. and that is actually freedom that is reflected through static of freedom, and that is poetry. And Ahmad al-Maqadmi is also similar. Also in the case of Hezbollah, you get some mystical images. There are some aesthetic merits, but I would say, on the whole, perhaps less than you would find in conscious poetry, in poetry that is consciously constructed with grappling with different elements of reality, and that doesn't have a particular political vision and system and ideology in place to dictate it. Because in the case of Abdulaziz al-Rantisi or al-Maqadmi or other Hamas poets, and sometimes they're very close-minded, it's sometimes terrible, really. But in the case of those poets, you see a kind of... you see the ideology. You do find the ideology prevails over the form and the content of the poetry. In the case of the other poets, it's the element of freedom and the ability to interpret the poetry from different perspective. It's much more, and the space for that is much more.
I have a question there at the end. Yeah.
I just want to talk about accessibility again. So you mentioned that poetry is accessible to kids, for example, in the Arab world. It is, but in a sense, it's still within a certain political narrative, and they're prevented from looking at it from a critical point of view.
Yeah. I'm not sure what you mean by critical, but...
So, like, critical thought towards poetry. So, not to have the fact that it's literature,
yeah,
and poetry in general is taught in Arab schools in Arab countries from a one dimension, or if you want dimension, basically. Young people are not encouraged towards critical thought or to kind of, yeah.
I mean, that's a problem. I mean, that's partly is a problem of education in the Arab world in terms of memorization, sometimes at the expense or to the detriment of analysis or to the detriment of free thought in general. But I would say there is also a new opening now, which is with the social media. I'm quite struck by how accessible it is to people from... Actually, where I come from, Rafah, I mean, I'm in contact with my family in Gaza. I'm quite struck by how accessible things have become to them in terms of language, in terms of literature, in terms of imagery, in terms of visual effects, in a way that I wouldn't have dreamed of when I was in Gaza. So, this would have to be studied and how to be able to give you like a conclusive judgment, which is really beyond me, but I can't do that. But I would say that there, perhaps these mediums have facilitated sort of thought of some sort that is more than before. But also I think more can be done in the area of education and critical thoughts. That certainly is the case. And also the fact that it's quite interesting how technology is used in that regard. Like, sometimes it's utterly abused. So it's actually the contest between political forces and political visions and ideologies is still there.
Final question, Bobby, and then...
Yeah,
that's a... Perhaps you have some very interesting...
Yes.
Right there.
I think that's actually is a very... I think this has always been... I think there has always been a connection between individual aspect. I mean, in the past it would be... and this is not studied enough, I think, between poetry and architecture, for example. The architecture that one sees in Andalusia and that is written... that there are poetry about, that is a very interesting field that has not been studied enough, actually. Mm-hmm. Like the idea of when you see, if you go to Al-Hamra, you see lions, Al-Asad, and that is a very prominent image in the poetry of the time. But in the modern period, I think there have been a lot of very interesting works, visual works, that were exhibited at the British Museum, for example, of Darwish's poetry. Adonis himself has turned some of his poetry and works of individual sort of works and pieces. I think this is actually is a very, because it's connected with calligraphy as well. I mean, in his case, calligraphic works have been have come out of that field. And also recently in the revolution, a lot of visual graffiti and poetry have sort of went hand in hand, side by side. Particularly in Egypt, for example, Ahmed Fuad Najm, colloquial poetry was depicted alongside images and so on. And I've been recently in Morocco, which is also very interesting, actually, because you see paintings that are totally inspired by poems. And sometimes you need actually an artist to tell you how this was done so. Like you see the poems being buried inside a painting of some sort, and then the city is built, or this particular representation is made like the city or a square. And some, so the visual and the poetic, as the oral aspect of poetry, is very much interesting, and there's much of it there. But there's more, I think there, this is an area that is really interesting to study and find out more about. And online as well is also very interesting in terms of the social media, like, has been populated with images where your poetry and visual aspects integrated as well.
But I think we're almost coming to an end of our talk tonight, but I think what is interesting here, and perhaps what you have made us think about in this talk, beyond the book, is the idea of poetry as not being static, and the way that it can be appropriated in different ways. So, for example, we have poetry in song, you know, the songs of the poetry that become very much part of our, you know, well, lives, and we hear them all the time. So the idea of sound, but the sound turning to song, or perhaps how it is kind of, you know, the imagination that it inspires, thinking about issues. I think, you know, sort of just listening to Arthur, you probably know why the book is important, and also how much you can still tell us about poetry, perhaps another book coming forward. So thank you again, Arthur, for this opportunity and to hear you talk about the book. And thank you, Mosaic Rooms, for hosting us, and thank you all for coming to the talk.